Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 219, I chat with Dror Gill, CTO of Beamer, about reducing the size of photos and videos without compromising image quality. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 14th, 2014. Episode 219, Beamer Bitrate Bonanza. Help support TWiT with your Amazon purchases. Visit twit.tv/Amazon, click on the Amazon banner, and shop as usual. That's twit.tv/Amazon, and we thank you for your support. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and editor of avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Dror Gill, the CTO of a company called Beamer, B-E-A-M-R, located in Tel Aviv, Israel, making him the farthest guest, the guest who has come to us from the farthest distance on Home Theater Geeks so far. Hey, Dror, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to be here.
And thank you for staying up so late. Before we get started, those of you who are logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv or watching live at live.twit.tv can post questions for us as we go, and I will pass along as many as I can. So, Dror, you started the company Beamer some years ago?
Yeah, like 5 years ago.
5 years ago. Tell us about how you started it, why you started it. What are you trying to achieve with the company?
So the company was founded by Sharon Carmel. He's a serial entrepreneur here in Israel. He had several companies before that. One of them was public on the London Stock Exchange and reached a valuation of a few billion dollars. And this was his third company. He wanted to solve an issue. Actually, he started with photos. How can we make the size of photo files, of JPEG files, smaller? So he called me in. I was working at the time as a consultant to several companies in the area of media and video and compression. And we started to think how we can make the files smaller. So all of those online services that have millions and millions of photos can save a lot in their storage costs. And delivery of the photos and sharing would be faster.
And, but actually, it's the point. Sorry, go right ahead.
So it's an interesting story. Actually, we started not with optimizing the JPEGs, but converting them to a different format, which was more efficient. That's how we wanted to solve the issue. Because JPEG is quite an old standard. It's from the 80s. And since then, there's been a lot of progress in image and video compression. And actually, it's not well known, but in every video codec, you have an image compressor. Because video codecs, first they compress images, and then after you have a certain image compressed, like the first image in a sequence, you compress the differences between this image and the next images in the video file. But first of all, and this repeats every few seconds, you need to have a full image compressed. And this image in video speak is called an iframe or an intraframe. And this is like...
Is the iframe the one that you start with?
Yes.
Okay.
It's so the one that you start with.
So we're talking with video. We're talking about video here, which is a sequence of still images after all. And you take the first one, which is called an iframe, and you compress it as you normally would.
Right. Right. And every few seconds in the video stream, you have another iframe. And other than the iframes, you have P frames, which are predicted from the iframe. So it's that's just the differences of pixels between the frames and the iframes. But we were interested in those iframes because it turns out that the compression of those iframes in the video standards, in particular in H.264, which at that time was the most modern video standard, is very efficient, and it's more efficient than JPEG. Mm-hmm. So our idea was to take those JPEGs and convert them into H.264 iframes. And then we save on the file size, and we have smaller files representing those images. If we do that conversion on millions of photos, we can save a lot of storage. That was the original idea we started with. And almost immediately we came up with a problem. You take a JPEG, you want to compress it into an H.264 iframe. What compression parameter do you use? How do you make sure that this iframe that you're creating has exactly the same quality of the original JPEG, and you have not degraded the quality of JPEG while creating that image, that H.264 iframe image?
I suppose so, you could look at it just by eye,
yeah.
But I think that that might not be an acceptable way to do it, because you know the eye can be fooled. You don't see everything. There had better be a better way to do it.
Right, and it's not practical to do it on millions of images. You can't people that will look at all the photos on Flickr or on Picasa and set the compression parameter. So we were looking at quality measures. Quality measure is a mathematical formula that takes two images and compares them and tries to tell you whether they are the same or not. And it turned out that existing quality measures were not good enough. Quality measures that are common, for example, are PSNR. PSNR is just the difference of pixels between two images.
What does PSNR stand for?
It's a pseudo signal to noise ratio. It tries to measure the difference. It takes a logarithm of the difference of the pixels between two images.
Okay.
The mathematical difference of the pixel values is not a very good measure of actual quality. Because you can imagine that if, for example, I have a very thin line across the photo, which is one pixel wide, but it's very visible. It's like a hair that you see on the photo. In terms of PSNR, there's no difference because it's only very few pixels, and this averages out when you compute the PSNR measure. On the other hand, I can reduce all of the pixels by a few levels of brightness, and then this will almost not be seen as a difference between the images, but the PSNR will be very large. So there's not a good correlation between PSNR values and actual visual quality. And that's what we found. So we knew we couldn't use PSNR as a measure to tell us that we've compressed to the right level. And we also looked at other quality measures, but we couldn't find a good one. So we ended up developing our own quality measure. And this is a quality measure that we called BBCQ, block-based coding quality. Because the quality measure we developed was especially tuned to detect the artifact of block-based coding, like JPEG, like MPEG, and like H.264. All of these are block-based.
So can you explain a little bit about what block-based coding is? How does it work?
So in most image and video coding schemes, you take the image, you divide it into separate blocks, and you encode each one of those blocks. This goes through a process, transforming to the frequency domain and doing entropy compression. But basically, you divide it into separate blocks.
And now how many blocks typically would you use? 16, 32, probably some power of 2, right?
Yeah, it depends. In JPEG, it's typically it's 8x8 blocks. In H.264, it can be 4x4, and it could be 16x16. In HEVC, they have even more sizes of the blocks, so it will be more flexible. But even this division into blocks by itself create artifacts. These are called blocking artifacts because you can see the boundaries between blocks in the image.
Is this why sometimes when you see a highly compressed MPEG stream, say coming from Netflix or whatever, you can actually sometimes see the blocks?
That's right. You can see the blocks when the bitrate is very low and it's highly compressed. And this is very annoying to the eye.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Sometimes you have an error in the stream and then it kind of explodes into blocks because there are some parameters that are missing. But anyway, what we did was quantify the artifacts of all of these type of block-based codecs, giving us a quality measure that had very good correlation with human results. We actually tested it by taking a group of people that have no knowledge of image compression and showing them two photos and asking them whether they look alike or not and which one of them is the lower quality photo. And it turns out that our quality measure could predict very reliably what they would say about the photos, whether they look alike or not. So the quality measure was our key. What we did when compressing JPEG to H.264 iframe was compress to a certain level, then take our quality measure and check what is the value, then compress to another level, check the value again, until we converge on a value that we knew is good in terms of quality, what we call perceptually lossless, which means a human cannot see any difference. And we used, for that particular image, that compression level. And of course, the compression level was different for every image because in each image, depending on the content, the resolution, the original compression, you would have different artifacts.
Sure. So for example, some picture might have a lot of flat blue sky, which would be very easy to compress a lot, whereas another picture might have a lot of fine detail in it, and you wouldn't be able to compress it as much without noticing the artifacts.
Exactly. So if you use blind compression, like compression always to a certain level, then some photos would be too large and other photos you would see quality degradation. In our method, we compress each image to the lowest size possible because we analyze the image and adapt the compression to the image content, specifically based on the artifacts that are expected during the compression process. So we started off with this idea of doing JPEG to H.264 iframes. We tested it on a bunch of images and we got very good results. We could reduce them like 5 times or 6 times of their normal size. So they were reduced like 80-85%. And that was really impressive. The only problem we had was that we ended up with images that were H.264 iframe. So how do you play these images? How do you display them? You know, you could use a standard H.264 player to play those images, but then the movie would stop after one frame because each movie was just one frame. So it didn't really make sense. I mean, some players would freeze on that last frame. Other players would just go blank after the movie ended. So we had no idea what would happen. So if we wanted to continue with that method, we would have to deploy our own decoding software that would display the H.264 iframe images. And we knew that pushing this software, non-standard, the proprietary software that just displays H.264 iframes, would be very difficult for us market-wise. So it wasn't a very good path for the company. So like any good startup, we did a small pivot. And then we asked ourselves, what if we used a similar quality measure to the one we developed, but instead of transcoding JPEG to H.264 iframe, we would just recompress the JPEG. We'd take a JPEG and encode it into another JPEG at a different compression level while checking the quality measure to make sure we don't introduce any artifacts in that process. So actually, we were asking ourselves, how much of this gain did we get from the better mathematical formulas used in the H.264 standard versus JPEG, and how much of the gain did we get because we have a good quality measure with a good correlation with subjective results? So we modified the quality measure a bit so it would fit JPEG to JPEG compression, and we tested it again on a large collection of photos. And to our surprise, we found that most of the gain was due to the quality measure. So even when we do JPEG to JPEG compression, we can still get the image down to 4 times or 5 times smaller than the original size, reduce it by 75% or 80%, and still retain the same quality. So actually, we found out that H.264 iframes gave us an additional 20 to 25% boost in the compression. But the main part of the compression came from the quality measure. So we decided from a marketing perspective, you know, it would be great if we could just output standard JPEGs. Anybody could use them. And the value is pretty clear. You take a JPEG from your camera. It can be 3 or 4 megabytes size. You apply our JPEG optimization process, and then you get a file that's 1 megabyte or even smaller. So that's a very nice gain that you get. Once you optimize your files, they occupy less space on your hard drive. You can send them to somebody else much faster, and even your cloud storage gets more efficient. So there's a lot of benefits, and we named this technology JPEG Mini because it takes a JPEG and it makes it much smaller.
And the key point to take away from this, I think, is that it reduces the size of a JPEG photo by 75, 80%, something like that, without degrading the image quality as you look at it. If you were to take that image and the original image and put them up next to each other, what you're saying is that most humans, anyway, would not be able to see the difference.
Exactly. If you look at the image at the normal distance from your screen, at actual size or 100% zoom, where every pixel is a pixel on your screen and you're not inventing any pixels, and you're also not combining any pixels, so this is the actual size of the photo that you took, then you won't be able to see any difference. And also, if you print your photo, even at a very large size, at any size that correlates to the resolution of your photo, you still won't be able to see any difference between JPEG Mini and the original image. We're actually posting, in a day or two, we're going to post a very nice video that was done by one of our users, where they took a guy who is in the printing business for 25 years, and they printed a huge photo of original and JPEG Mini. And the guy goes on with a loop and tries to find the difference, and he can't tell the difference, and he can't identify which one is the original and which one is the JPEG Mini.
Wow. Now, is this something that is available to, consumers, end users, or is it only for businesses and so on?
It is available to consumers. You have two ways that you can use it as a consumer. You can go to the website, jpegmini.com, and that is actually a free web service. If you sign up at jpegmini.com, and signing up is free, you can upload as many images as you want to our web service. We optimize the images, and then you can download all of the optimized images. And this service is completely free and unlimited. So that's one way you can use JPEG Mini optimization. We also have desktop software that you can use either on a PC or a Mac. And we have a trial version that is free that lets you optimize 20 photos a day. And then we have a paid version that costs $20. And this lets you optimize locally on your computer an unlimited amount of photos. And this has been going pretty well. We have a lot of users for this software who get the benefit of optimizing the files. Like if they have 100 gigabytes of photos on the local drive, they run it through JPEG Mini, they can end up with 20 or 25 gigabytes, and all the rest is free for them to use for other stuff. For example,
more photos.
for more photos or for video. Another interesting use case, you can take your Dropbox folder on your computer, drag it onto the JPEG Mini software, and that will optimize locally all of the photos in your Dropbox. Now, after Dropbox detects that your photos have changed, it will sync those smaller photos back to your cloud account on Dropbox. So your photos will be smaller on the cloud, and you'll have more space left on your Dropbox account to store even more photos. So if you have a free account, you don't have to pay. If you have a paid account, you don't have to upgrade after you run JPEG Mini and all of your photos in Dropbox.
And the other critical thing to remember here is that this process, thanks to your BBCQ quality metric, is automatic. You don't have to sit there and do anything. It can batch process as many photos as you want, and it automatically does it, and you can be sure that what comes out of this box of this software is going to have the same visual quality as what came in, but be a lot smaller. And you can do it, and it can run in the background or do it while you go have lunch or whatever.
Right, right. So you can very easily and safely just drag your whole hard drive onto JPEG Mini. It will recursively scan all of your folders and optimize all of your photos. We also have a pro version for professional photographers, which supports a higher resolution, has higher performance, and it also has a Lightroom plugin. So in Adobe Lightroom, after you do all of your processing, you just plug in JPEG Mini, and when you save the photo to JPEG, it is already saved in its optimal format. So it fits very nicely into a photography workflow.
Mm-hmm.
And if you mentioned doing it automatically on millions of images, we also have a JPEG Mini server, which is a Linux product. This is for the enterprise market. And we already have customers using it today to optimize millions and millions of photos in the repository.
Quixton in the UK asks, does it take longer to do this compression than some standard form of compression?
No, actually, it's about twice as long as JPEG compression. Now, JPEG is quite a simple method of compression. Like on today's modern CPUs, even a single core can compress JPEG like 16 megapixels you can do in half a second. So with JPEG Mini, it will take you 1 second to do every image. So even if you have tens of thousands of images, you know, in a few hours, you'll be done with all of your images. And then all the new ones you can optimize. The JPEG Mini will skip all the images that have already been optimized and will only skip new and original images, and will only optimize the new and original images.
So do these files have a tag or some sort of identifier in them that lets JPEG Mini know that that it's already done its thing to them?
Yes, we use a very small EXIF field, which is a comment. And then we write that it was optimized by JPEG Mini and a certain version. Other than that, we don't modify the EXIF at all. So all of the metadata of the original image is retained in the JPEG Mini image.
Mm-hmm. Magpie asks, how does JPEG Mini handle aliasing in the conversion process?
Well, we typically do not run into this issue because the quality measure can detect any change between the original image and the JPEG Mini image. Okay, so everything is done under quality control using our quality measure. So any difference that is visible to the eye, we will detect it in the process and prevent this from happening by lowering the compression level.
Mm-hmm. CompuVision asks, do you have stats like compared with RAW or BMP images? JPEG, he says here, changes 11 to 13% of the pixels. JPEG Mini changes 2% more. Also, can you start with an uncompressed image, like a RAW image, and end up with a highly compressed but still good-looking JPEG image?
Yeah, well, I never counted the image, the pixels that are changed. And actually, we can do that if you have a lot of patience. Can go in and count them, but actually, what's important is what the user sees, and not some statistic about pixel differences. As I said, PSNR, which is pixel differences, is not very reliable in measuring the quality. Now, the reason we start from JPEG is that we need some reference for quality. Okay, so if the JPEG was compressed by the camera to a certain quality level, we preserve that quality. If you would feed an uncompressed image, then we would compress to a very low level because we would need to preserve all of the characteristics of the uncompressed image. We could not introduce any JPEG artifacts because there's not any in the original. So we don't think that is a very useful a use case. And right now, we only support optimizing from a JPEG to a smaller JPEG. What you could do, if you want to take an uncompressed image, you could encode it or compress it with JPEG at the highest quality, quality 100, and then run it through JPEG Mini, and that would work.
Okay. Untoward asks, how much more CPU is needed to decode these images? Will it kill the battery on mobile devices?
No. Decoding is as simple as a regular JPEG. No difference.
Yeah. I'm just checking in if I see any other real questions here. And I don't. So one question that comes to my mind is what you just said, and I think it's an important point. Let's make sure it's emphasized, which is what JPEG Mini will do is compress what you feed it, but not make it any better and presumably not make it any worse than what you feed it. So ideally, you want to feed it as high a quality as you can.
Right, right. If you feed it with a high quality, we can preserve that high quality with the lowest file size that is possible for preserving that high quality.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fantastic. Well, next we're going to start talking about video because we've so far been talking about photos, JPEGs, and right. Videos really is what Home Theater Geeks is more about. I mean, photos are great, and I take a ton of them myself, and I'm planning to use this myself. But video, I think, is even more difficult to do. Now, before we do that, I want to actually put a call out for help to our listeners and viewers. You can easily help TWiT by doing nothing more than what you already do. You're a listener of TWiT, you're a viewer of TWiT, and you probably shop on Amazon. Now, you already know, of course, if you do, that the price, selection, and convenience of Amazon.com is just great. I mean, I certainly do. I shop there all the time. And now you can help support TWiT with your Amazon purchases. It's easy. Just click on the Amazon banner at twit.tv/Amazon and shop as usual. It's as simple as that. Costs you nothing extra. And anything you purchase helps keep the lights on at the Brick House. Now, I've talked about how my wife just went to Europe and had to get some power converter, power adapter things for her trip. That was purchased on Amazon. And in fact, if you go to the twit.tv/Amazon page, you will see all kinds of interesting things there that are featured on that page, including the Logitech UE900 Ultimate Ears Noise Isolating Earphones. So these are sort of earbuds, and they have a little clip around the back. Many people that I've heard, I haven't tried it myself. I might, in fact, do so now that I see that they're here. But a lot of people I know really swear by them. And I'm big on noise-canceling headphones, so I really do want to check these out. And that's only one of many products here on the Amazon page at twit.tv, after which, of course, you simply click on the banner to the right and shop as usual. You can also do that from the UK and from Canada, so it's not only limited to the US, which is really, really great. So let's see here. Whatever you buy, we do want you to make sure to click through the Amazon banner at twit.tv/Amazon. It's a very easy way to support TWiT. And you can bookmark that page and click through our link every time you shop at Amazon. Certainly what I do. And I'm getting all my friends and family to as well. There are even links, as I said, for Amazon UK and Canada. Once again, that's twit.tv/Amazon. And we thank you very much for your support. Okay, I'm talking with Dror Gill, CTO of Beamer. And we've been talking about squeezing out more data from your JPEGs, making them smaller, without losing quality. And that's a really great application. But of course, this is Home Theater Geeks, and we want to talk about video. So, Dror, your original idea with this company was to convert JPEGs to H.264 iframes, but that was going to cause problems. I wonder, can you then take that original idea and apply it to video?
Yes, and this is exactly what we did. I think about after a year and a half or 2 years that we were into the JPEG optimization technology and developed our products, Then we said, okay, JPEGs, that's nice. There's a lot of photos in the world, but there's a lot more video in the world. And what if we could optimize those video streams using similar techniques? So we already had some experience because of our initial trials with JPEG to H.264 iframes. And so we knew what artifacts could be created through H.264 compression and how to quantify them. So we took the concept of the quality measure, which is block-based, and we extended it so it would cover the artifacts that are created by video compression. Video is different. The method of compression is different, and also the nature of the video, taking into account that you have many similar frames, it's different than a still image. So we extended our quality measure and started to experiment with optimizing video files. And again, we already learned our lesson. We're not going to create a new video codec or compression format. It was very important for us from the start that all of our output files would be standard H.264 video files. So you can play them anywhere, edit them, and you only need the optimization to happen at the encoding side. So the process for video works like this. We take an H.264 video file that's already compressed, that's encoded to a certain bit rate. We take that file, and on a frame-by-frame basis, we encode each frame again to a higher compression level, to a lower bit rate. And after we do that, we check using our quality measure whether we have introduced any artifacts in the process. And if we have, we take a lower compression ratio. If the quality measure is too high, we compress more until each frame reaches its optimal amount of compression without any artifacts being visible. So we do this for H.264 video on a frame-by-frame basis. And the output is another H.264 video file that has a bitrate that is lower than the input file, but the same subjective quality. So using the same criteria we have in JPEG, a human viewer, when viewed at 100% zoom on a screen, cannot distinguish between the original video and the video after optimization. And this technology is called Beamer Video.
We have a block diagram where I'd love to show that gives you an idea of sort of how this iterative process works. Here we can see it, those of you who are watching video. The image comes in, and you can see this sort of feedback loop, if you will. Dror, why don't you explain this diagram a little bit?
Yeah, so we have a component that controls the encoder and the amount of compression. And it tries to encode the frame into a certain compression level. And this outputs a candidate frame, which could go out to the stream if its quality is good enough. Now we take the candidate frame and we compare it to the original frame using our quality measure to see if it fits within the threshold. If it's not, if the quality is too low, then we lower the compression and create another candidate frame. It can also be that the quality is too high, meaning we could compress this frame more without creating artifacts, and then we apply a higher compression level. Finally, when we see that the candidate frame versus the original, the quality of that is within a threshold that we defined in our quality measure, this means that the candidate can go out to the stream, and it's exactly the optimal quality, and then we go into the next frame and repeat the process. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, this process is quite heavy because each frame, we need to go through the optimization process and the checking of the quality measure several times until we reach the target quality. So I would say typically that our encoder is about twice as slow as a regular video encoder because of the need to compress each frame several times. But generally, we can converge on two iterations per frame because we can do a smart guess as to what is the required compression level because the frames are similar to each other in a sequence. Then in about two iterations for each frame, we can get to the right compression level and move on to the next frame. And because of this reason, the computation power required for BIMO video optimization is about twice as regular video encoding.
You know, one of our chat roomers here, Untoward, kind of got that. He says, so this is all about second pass encoding and maybe third and fourth pass. Sounds like double load on the CPU encoder processor.
Definitely. But it is also definitely worth it. Because if you take a premium entertainment content, those clips that are viewed many times on YouTube or movies and TV shows that are streamed to audiences, millions of people every evening, then you come to the conclusion very quickly that it makes sense to invest two more encoding cycles on your content in order to reduce the bitrate. Because then you have a very strong benefit. You actually have a benefit that is a double benefit. To the content delivery guys, it means that you deliver less bits over the pipe. So it lowers your delivery costs. Your CDN costs are lower. And if you multiply that by the thousands and millions of people who are viewing each clip, it gets to significant savings. For the end user, you also have a benefit. For the end user, actually, the video streams better. Because you're pushing less bits over the pipe, then you have less buffering events, and you have a faster start for the stream. So actually, the perceived quality of the video is higher. So actually, you have a win-win situation here where the content provider and the end user both have benefits from reducing the bitrate, and there is no effect on quality, so it's only an advantage to do that. So I would say, and right now, our main customers are in the business of entertainment content and premium content that is streamed to users, because they know that the number of titles they have is limited, even if it's thousands of titles, but it makes sense to optimize. Actually, we did the calculation, and if your video is viewed more than 60 times, then you get a return on investment, both on the cost of CPU and on the cost of licensing BIMO video technology. So every video that you stream to more than 60 users, it makes sense to optimize it, because then you save on your delivery cost more than you invest in optimizing the video. And you can imagine what huge return on investment you have for a popular TV series or a highly viral YouTube video.
Mm. M5 is asking this question. This probably benefits broadcasters. Have you contacted broadcasters? And obviously you have. You may not be able to tell us who you're working with, but I assume that you have reached out to those people who provide this video content and said, we can help you.
Right, right. Currently, all of our customers are under confidentiality agreements, and we cannot say their name, but I hope that will change in a few weeks and we'll be able to announce some of our customers. One of them, by the way, is delivering premium content to mobile devices, and they have about 100,000 titles that they're delivering. They're licensed from a major studio, and they're seeing savings of 20 to 50% on the bitrate that they're delivering to mobile devices using BIMO video. Mm-hmm. So the benefit for them is really clear. BIMO video is an enterprise product. It's not available to end consumers. It's available only to companies. It's a Linux product that can run on-premise or in the cloud. And for this particular customer, we actually implemented a system that goes to their Amazon S3 bucket where they store the content, pulls the original files, optimizes them with BIMO video on our servers that are also located on Amazon AWS, and then pushes the optimized file back to the bucket. So we actually replace the files which are in their content management system, and this is totally transparent to them. So they only see the benefit, and integration was very quick.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, this won't work on to do real-time encoding. I mean, you need to pass each frame through two or three times. You know, you're not going to be able to just stream live compressed information, right?
Yes. Right now, it is not possible because our implementation is fully software-based. And when you use encoding parameters that are tuned to lower the bit rate, it's the heaviest load on the CPU, and you need to multiply that by two. So it currently does not work for live streams. Our focus is on OTT and on-demand streaming of titles. But the technology itself can be implemented in live. I mean, if we have a hardware encoder that can run sufficiently fast, for example, let's say you have a 4K video encoder and you're running it at 1080p, okay, then you have enough power to encode each full HD frame four times, because the 4K, the UHD frame is four times larger than mm-hmm. HD. So if you don't use that hardware encoder for 4K, you use it for HD, 1080p, then you have enough power with that hardware encoder to do Beamer video optimization. And we can apply our decisions on a software driver level and control the hardware encoder to enable live optimization of video. So mm-hmm. that is possible. We haven't implemented yet because our focus until now was on the software, but it's something that is possible to do once we partner with a provider of H.264 hardware encoding.
Yeah, Sandblaster in the chat room says, this seems to be for streaming only, and I guess for now it is, but you're hoping, I'm sure, to expand that to other applications as well.
Right. It is streaming only. I mean, it's not live. It's on-demand streaming.
Yeah.
But there are a few other applications that we support. One of them is download. If you have a site that lets you download movies, then if you optimize them, then the download is smaller. It takes less time to download. Another interesting project we're working on now with one of the studios is Blu-ray optimization. We're actually taking Blu-ray discs and reducing the bitrate of the video. And then what you can do is, for example, if you have a TV series, then it will take you less discs to deliver that TV series. So again, it's a matter of delivery cost. You have to burn less discs and deliver less discs to the end user. And that's another application of the technology. And here again, the user benefits, because if he's binging on a full TV series, he has to get up from his armchair less times in order to change the disc, because there's, you know, smaller number of discs in the box.
Oh man, this okay? is a lazy man.
I mean, yeah,
dream.
It's not good for your health, right? You need to get up from that couch. I know. But you know, theoretically, if you're very lazy, you know, we can help you. You don't have to get up so much in order to
change. Untoward, in fact, is making a similar, you know, commenter with a question. Will his video codec leverage H.264 encoder chips for acceleration? That's what you're talking about here, is hardware acceleration, hardware encoder chips that are dedicated to doing only that.
Right. And we can use those chips if we integrate with them, and that will enable live optimization of video using Beamer video.
Mm-hmm. So you said that your current Beamer video technology can reduce the size and bitrate by, I think you said, 25 to 50%?
Yes, 20 to 50%, yes.
20 to 50%. Again, depending on what's in the image. I mean, if there's a lot of stuff going on in that image, probably less than if it's a simple image or animation, for example.
Right, and it's also average across all of the clips. So if there are certain parts of the video title which have a lot of action, then we know we can reduce less. And in other parts that have mainly static, then we can reduce more.
Mm-hmm. How about you've been working with H.264, which up till recently was the main video codec. Nowadays, we have HEVC or H.265, high efficiency video codec. Are you starting to work with HEVC, and will you be able to reduce its bitrate even more?
Yes, the answer is definitely yes. Because HEVC, the advantages that you get in HEVC over H.264, it's not 50%, it's up to 50%. And 50% you get in very specific situations, but it is more efficient than H.264. But this efficiency has been reached through the use of mathematical formulas. As we discussed earlier, the size of the blocks. So you have more sizes to the blocks. You have more ways to partition your image and to tile your image. You have a different way to encode the entropy, to encode the the parameters of the compression themselves are encoded in a more efficient way. But even in HEVC, there is no subjective quality measure that is used in the encoding process. No HEVC encoder is looking at the decoded frame, comparing it to the original frame using some quality measure, and making decisions based on a subjective quality measure. So even with HEVC, there is room for subjective-based optimization. And this is what we are starting to do. We already demonstrated at NAB this year the reduction of an HEVC bitstream by 40% using Beamer video technology. This was a prototype, and by the end of this year, we plan to productize it and have a product for optimizing HEVC streams. So imagine HEVC up to 50% better than H.264, and then on top of that, you apply Beamer video optimization and get an additional gain.
Pretty amazing. Good Sound asks in the chat room, how does Beamer video compare to H.265 draft standard?
Well, I think in most cases, we're using the term HEVC instead of the H.265. But basically it's two names for the same codec.
Right, exactly. I had a question here. Hang on a second. Where is it? Sentinel asks, would this ever be available to the end users so that they could, for example, rip their Blu-rays to a network-attached storage, NAS, and save storage space? That is, for those who live in countries where this is legal.
Well, this is legal, yes. In any case, I would see a very strong benefit in optimizing your video files. For example, video files that you captured with a camera, with a DSLR or with your point-and-shoot camera, typically when I come back from a trip, the largest size of files in the folder of that trip is from the video I captured and not from the still images.
Right.
And I look at my external hard drive, maybe 150 gigs are still images and 700 are video. So I think there is a strong need for that also in the consumer space. And it is something we are looking at in the future. Right now, we are focusing on the enterprise space. We want to get, and we are getting, a lot of positive feedback from Hollywood, from the studios, who are saying this stuff is amazing. It preserves the quality. And these are the guys who are responsible for creating the content. So their word is what is important. So what we think is, after we get the wins in the studios and in the content delivery, and build our brand as a technology that preserves quality while reducing bitrate, then we can go to the consumer and say, listen, Hollywood is using this, you know, Netflix or maybe somebody else is using it. You can safely use it in your home, optimize all of your videos and save a lot of space locally on your hard drive, in your external drives, and also on the cloud.
Rusty Bones in the chat room is asking, seems like a wide variation, 20 to 50%. Bitrate reduction, will that affect playback?
No, it doesn't affect playback because this variation is between different clips. Typically for a single clip, you don't get that variation in the bitrate. You get a certain amount of reduction. And if you look at the bitrate graph, it follows pretty closely the graph of the original original video, but at a lower scale. So we've tested it using local playback. We've also tested it with various types of streaming, like HLS, and there are no issues in streaming Beamer video content. You can stream it as you do your original content. Mm-hmm. Another interesting use case is ABR, you know, adaptive bitrate. There are many content providers that build like 10 different versions, different bitrates, different resolutions of the same content for streaming to different devices that have different capabilities and for streaming over varying network conditions. And with adaptive bitrate, the client reports to the server what's the current bandwidth that's available. And based on that, the server sends the client a specific stream. So what Beamer Video does, when we optimize a stream, we preserve the sync points, what is called the iframes that we mentioned before. That mm-hmm. is where you can switch between streams, and we preserve that in the stream. So if you had a bunch of streams that were synchronized before Beamer Video, adaptive bitrate set, then after Beamer Video, the same adaptive bitrate set will still be synchronized, and you'll be able to use it with all of your players.
You know, this brought to mind my question, which was constant bitrate versus variable bitrate. I assume Beamer Video can deal with both of those.
Yes, we can take at our input both VBR and CBR streams, but our output is inherently variable in its bitrate because we don't have a rate control that specifies what is the output bitrate of the stream. We're strictly quality driven. So each frame, the number of bits allocated is based on the quality measure and how much we can reduce without introducing artifacts. That's mm-hmm. why at the output, we are inherently variable bitrate. But we can take, for example, a constant bitrate stream and lower the bitrate and output a variable bitrate stream that is the smallest representation of that constant bitrate stream after Beamer Video optimization. One thing you can do if CBR or constant bitrate is very important to you, you can use the output of Beamer Video and pad the bitrate using some dummy bytes until you get to the highest bitrate that was produced, and then you get a constant bitrate stream. But in that case, you don't get the best benefit in terms of bitrate reduction as you would in a variable bitrate stream.
Sandblaster in the chat room is asking, how will Beamer of today work with UHD of tomorrow?
Yeah, that's a very good question. First of all, Beamer Video today supports Ultra HD resolutions. But what we are seeing is that there's not a lot of place in the market for UHD using H.264. And mostly UHD deployment will be done using HEVC. So as I said before, we've demonstrated HEVC capability. And by the end of the year, HEVC will be integrated into the Beamer Video product. And this will come naturally together with UHD support. So we will support UHD HEVC by the end of the year. Now, this is UHD is a very important use case for us because what we're seeing in the market is that even with HEVC compression, you cannot get UHD content down to a bandwidth that is reasonable for the average consumer. Okay, you still need 15 to 20 megabits in order to stream UHD using HEVC. So if this, you apply
This is the problem that I've often cited as one of the problems. I mean, we know that UHD is probably going to be delivered first by streaming. But to get any kind of reasonable quality, as you say, you need 15 to 20 megabits. And in the US, that's not so common. I don't know about Israel. What is the average bit rate into the home in Israel?
I think 10 to 12 is about the average.
Okay. So, you know, it might be something around that here, although I've seen figures as low as 3 megabits per second as an average, as a per capita average coming into U.S. homes, which is barely enough for HD, much less UHD.
That's right. And this will increase. I saw that, at least in some locations, getting up to 9 megabits. But 15 to 20 is only for the high end of the users. If you take Beamer Video optimization and you apply it to that HEVC stream that's 15 to 20 megabits, you can reduce it significantly. And then a much wider range of audience and connections can get access to the UHD stream. And this really opens up a wider market for Ultra HD.
CompuVision asks, it seems odd to have to encode with another system first in order to get the bitrate down to what your hardware and stream will handle, then let Beamer improve it. I'm not sure that that's quite what you're going for here.
Yeah, Beamer is not improving it. It's improving the bitrate. It's reducing the bitrate.
It's but not improving the image. It's maintaining the image.
Maintaining the image and reducing the bitrate. But he's right in that we need that initial encode as a reference quality for us. Again, if you would feed us with raw video, RGB or YUV, something that is not compressed, Beamer Video would apply the quality measure. Any small artifact would be noticed. And for this reason, we would have to encode at a very high bitrate, like 200, 300 megabits. And that's not practical. So we need to start with something that's already encoded, and then we can optimize that encoding and lower the bitrate. We need that as a reference for quality.
Got it. So what can you tell us about the future plans? I know you're going to IBC, which is a big trade show in Amsterdam, and you're going to be showing some stuff there. You may not be able to tell us much because you're probably under NDA until then or sometime in the future, but can you give us any sense of where you're going from here forward?
Well, at IBC, we will announce some exciting stuff, but again, we want to announce it there, so right now it's under embargo, but it will be something that really helps the users of the product to utilize Beamer Video in the best way. So we're talking about usability improvements and also some major performance improvements. And as you understand, performance is a key issue with the video optimization because of the heavy processing power. So right. We talk about these two issues. We have some exciting news that we're going to announce at IBC. So that's the first step in our roadmap. As I said, towards the end of the year, we'll have the HEVC solution. And next year, we're looking at integrating with hardware encoding to enable fully live, real-time optimization of video streams.
Wow. I can't quite see how that would work because, without some delay, because you're each frame is going through an iterative process. It's got to have some delay, maybe only a frame or two at a time, which I guess would be okay for live streaming.
Right. That is the delay you're talking about. You have a delay of two frames, and then we output the video. And I think that's for most practical applications, that is very, very reasonable delay.
Mm-hmm.
Some live broadcasts even introduce a delay for regulatory reasons that is much larger than that.
Yeah, indeed. Sentinel asks an interesting question. Will this free up bandwidth? He's talking about HDMI 2.0 and how HDMI 2.0 is already kind of maxed out, especially if you consider a wider color gamut, greater bit depth, higher frame rates. So I would presume that applying Beamer Video to something that has these other parameters, wider dynamic range, greater bit depth, wider color space, and so on, could only help HDMI 2.0 carry what it needs to, right?
Well, HDMI itself carries a raw video, which is uncompressed.
Oh, that's true. You know what? That's true. So by the time it gets onto the HDMI stream, your job is done. It's finished.
Well, nothing that we can do about it. It carries the pixels themselves. There's no compression going on whatsoever. But if you're talking about those higher bit depth and more colors and color spaces that are less decimated than the regular ones, then you have more pixels, more colors, more bits, and this increases the bitrate when you encode using any video encoder. So if we talked previously about 15 to 20 megabits for HEVC that stream to the home, okay, this is before improving the quality of the raw video and going to 10 bit or 12 bit. And then going to 422 or 444 color, that will increase bitrate even more.
Yeah.
So if you want the antidote for that stuff, you need media optimization. because each one of those steps takes you even higher and higher in the required bitrate. So you need something to pull you back into a bitrate that is reasonable for streaming or for download.
Mm-hmm. And Beamer Video will certainly do that. If you feed it something that was encoded in HEVC, say, with, you know, 10 or 12 bit video and 444 color and so on, you'll still be able to compress that down a lot further than you would otherwise be able to do.
Yes, that's right. One of the interesting use cases is taking a ProRes file. When video files are being transferred between studio and a content provider or for editing, they're typically encoded in a ProRes in 10-bit and 422. But these files are very, very large. You could encode them in H.264, but actually you don't know what bitrate to use for each file because you don't want to hurt the quality. So an interesting use case for Beamer Video would be to transcode from ProRes into H.264, and then you get the optimal H.264 for that ProRes. So you encode at exactly the right bitrate that is needed in order to preserve the full quality of that ProRes file.
Mm-hmm. Untoward asks, what about dropped frames? When using this technology on streamed video and a frame is dropped, is the recovery period longer?
No, it is the same, because as I said, what we output is fully standard H.264 video. It is exactly the same frame rate as the input. Actually, when you stream lower bitrate, there is a less chance of frames being dropped and packets being lost because they are smaller and easier to deliver.
Yeah, okay. Specs asks, is your company participating with any standards bodies?
We are following and implementing H.264 and HEVC standards. But because all we do is in the compression domain and on the encoding side, on the decoding side, you don't need any software. You use a regular H.264 or HEVC player that can be a computer, a set-top box, smart TV, a mobile device, whatever player you have for your content will work with Beamer Video. So there's no need to introduce a new standard into the ecosystem. It's just optimization that is fully done within the standard codecs.
Yeah, well, that makes a lot of sense, because what the output of the Beamer Video system is just another H.264 or HEVC bitstream. It looks identical to one that hadn't been processed, except that it's using less space and bitrate.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, we've come to the end of an hour, a fascinating hour, and I want to thank you so much for being here, especially so late, or rather so early in the morning for you. Thanks so much for being here.
It was so exciting. I didn't even notice the time passing, and I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity and for hosting me on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. That's Dror Gil, CTO of Beamer, B-E-A-M-R. And their website is beamervideo.com. Also, jpegmini.com for what we were talking about earlier in the show, which is reducing the size of your JPEG photos. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and also at avsforum. You can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, we're going to be talking about the Value Electronics Flat Panel Shootout, which is happening this coming weekend. So we're going to talk about it next Thursday with Robert Zahn, the owner of Value Electronics, Kevin Miller, one of the calibrators who made sure that all the TVs, who will make sure, is probably as we speak making sure that all of the TVs in the shootout are calibrated and on a level playing field. And my colleague at AVS Forum, Mark Henninger, who will be attending the shootout as a participant and observer. So that will be very fascinating. We'll be talking about all kinds of different flat panel TVs and how they did in the shootout. It's a two-day event, and once a year, it's a very exciting thing, and I'm very glad to have all three of those guys on the show next week. And I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.